Hi everybody, welcome to the DieCast. I'm Seamus. With me is Josh.
Hello.
And also Chris.
I am a person who is here.
And Rutskarn is here as well.
And my alternate universe twin.
Well, now I feel really inadequate because I didn't come up with anything interesting to say.
So
don't worry guys, he's about 30 seconds behind me, so we won't be overlapping each other. And my alternate universe twin.
This is terrible.
What have we done?
What is everybody doing this week? Josh, what are you doing this week?
I have been playing a bunch of Crusader Kings 2, which I pre-ordered it when it came out in like last year sometime, and I played a bunch of it, but then I stopped playing it. But Randy and I recently got back into it, and we've been playing some multiplayer games together. Taking over the Eastern Roman Empire, which is always fun, especially when you don't succeed and the emperor takes away all of your land. That's nice.
you know what? You just no, you're done here. Go home. I'll take this.
Yeah,
well, no,
pretty much.
I'm going to take your home. So find a new one somewhere far away from me. Thank you. Good day.
Or better, Randy actually he got his character imprisoned in a battle against, like, in a civil war against the emperor, and he was imprisoned for one day and was released, and when he was released he was missing his eyes. So yeah, that game is pretty fun.
Mm. Yeah, that sounds fun.
Hey, I wasn't the one who managed to get myself captured and then blinded, so I mean, I'm fine.
So, Chris, what are you playing?
Very little, because I'm on full-on edit mode at this point. Mostly, I've been playing games in 5-10-minute spurts to get footage. I did play a little bit of DLC Quest, which was kind of cool, going back and sort of money-grubbing and stealing things. My only real complaint with DLC Quest is it doesn't feel angry enough. Like, I really enjoyed playing it, because it does sort of set up this satire of a lot of industry conventions. There's lots of gaming jokes, and things that if you've been paying attention to the business of games that you would be able to make fun of, and basically if you watch this podcast or listen to this podcast, you'd get most of the jokes, not because we made them, but because it's that sort of audience. But it's
you
all
hear that,
sort of
guys? You're erudite.
That's right. Heck yeah, they are. But it's sort of done. It's okay, Josh. We'll explain it to you after the show. But it is very lighthearted in its satirizing of games, and I think it could have stood to have the protagonist get a little bit more frustrated with how much he was getting screwed over and aggravate the player a little bit more. But aside from that, I really enjoyed it. But that's basically all I've been playing, because I've mostly been editing and capturing footage and doing other boring stuff like that.
Okay, Rutskarn, what you up to?
Well, a couple things. I finished BioShock Infinite and will proceed never to talk about it because you have to wait until absolutely everyone else in the universe has finished BioShock Infinite before we discuss the story in public. I've had a few RPGs that aren't really worth talking about within the purview of this podcast, and I strangled my alternate universe clone to death when he tried to eat one of my tacos. Oh, and I installed Thief 2 again. So that's fun.
So this is pretty much a normal week for you. And you made me jealous. I was looking for my Thief 2 disc last night. I wanted to play some Thief 2 and I couldn't find it. And
you're
I was
still
feeling sad.
Discs.
What are you going to buy Thief 2 on? What were you going to go back in time and buy it on Steam
in
1999?
I have Thief 2 on Steam.
Thief 2's on God.
But I bought it back in the day, and I still have the disc. Yes, I'm not going to buy it again when I already own it. That makes no sense. Actually, when
right,
I
because
find
I
disc,
do that I'm... all the time.
Oh, really? Well, it was $10. Yeah. If it had been $5, I might have done it.
I've actually bought Morrowind like 4 or 5 times at this point. It's sad.
I am playing a lot. I made an effort to play a whole bunch of indie games this week, and I played DLC Quest, and I'm just going to say yes, everything Chris said about it. I agree. Chris pretty much covered the game. I was charmed by it. I thought it was really funny. I also played Thomas Was Alone. I don't have a lot to say about that because I haven't really gotten very far in that. I played Kerbal Space Program, which is incomplete, so I don't know what to say about it because it's not done. It's really interesting so far, but I keep running into... I'm just playing the demo, and so it's like, well, I don't know if this is an unfinished feature or something that's not available in the demo or what, so I kind of don't know what to make of it. Except to say I love the idea, and when they finish it, I'll be back to check it out more. And I found Battlefield Bad Company 2 for $5, and I played it in with all these indie games, and it really is it's interesting because it, just to contrast it with the other ones, because it cost more than all these other games combined, and it really is just this soulless, artless, vapid, it is as bad as I remember those games being, and it is sort of mind-boggling when I look at the incredible production values that went into making a story with absolutely no emotional payload and barely any plot and really boring gameplay and no player agency. So it was kind of... But it's a little bit old. You know, I'm not just sneering at the game because everybody loves it right now because it's the new thing. No. This is a game from years ago. Looking back... objectively, it really is an uninteresting game. But the most interesting game I played this week, the one that I loved the most, and you were going to laugh, we made fun of this game so many times. I don't think we did it on the podcast, but usually before the podcast.
That's what that stands for.
Yes, you know what I'm talking about, Josh.
He has it in the notes as ETS 2013, and I was like, what is that?
It's Euro Truck Simulator 2013.
Why?
Didn't I talk about the cover to that game? On an episode of the podcast? That cover
are we
going
to have to make a spoiler warning episode now called Highway to Nowhere?
I really love, there was a journalist piece that was trying to figure out why these are always such high sellers, and I don't, have you guys read that? There was a, I can't remember where it was.
I have not.
You know what? I started reading that, and then I restarted my computer and forgot to pull it back up.
It was just really interesting because as much as these games get made fun of by traditional core gamers, that, you're driving a truck, it's stupid. What really fascinates me about it is that apparently they have... they did an interview with the people that make it and all the other sim games that they make, and apparently it's really interesting because their big audience is basically the... either end of the gaming spectrum in terms of age. You either get real little kids that, trucks, yay, I'm like driving a truck, yay, it's big. Then they immediately drive it off the road because they're 5 or whatever, but they love trucks.
You're just saying exactly what happened. I handed the game. My daughter came over, got excited, wanted to try it, and crashed her truck.
But wait a minute, you're saying that if you started to play a game about driving trucks, you would not immediately find a great big cliff to drive the truck off of?
During that Steam sale where everybody, the Christmas one, where everyone got free crap and a lot of the free crap was really bad games, I got a truck simulator, and I actually did one of the missions. I only did one or two of the missions and then uninstalled it, but yeah, I just delivered the goods like a grown-up would. I'm boring.
This game, it's interesting because this is... Oh, what are you saying, John?
I can't come up with any proper retort because, yes, you are boring.
Well, the other audience that they had were, like, actual truckers. They weren't, like, 18 to 34-year-olds. They were 35, 45-year-old dudes who actually do a lot of that stuff. And also people that live in, like, Eastern Europe buy a lot of this stuff because... to them, trucking isn't sort of like this blue collar looked down upon career. It's a bunch of guys that get to go out and see all of Europe, and that's amazing to a bunch of people that might be, you know, stuck somewhere in a small town somewhere in you know, Far East Europe. And
It's
it was a really
romantic to
interesting
them.
thing. It is, and I say that without any irony. It genuinely is.
Yeah. I can see that. And why I like this game is it is it for one thing, it's the best driving physics I've ever played. I mean, I haven't played a ton of driving games, but I've played everything from Gran Turismo to Mario Kart to driving around in GTA. And I've never run into, and even the Burnout games, and I've never run into one that I actually felt like I was operating an automobile. There's always a bit of that video gamey feel to them. And this one, I actually had that sense of space and awareness that, holy cow, this is a massive vehicle. It's got a ton of mass. I think the big key is that really made this experience different is one thumbstick steers and the other thumbstick looks around. So you can turn your head in an intersection instead of doing the GTA thing where you can't really like look both ways before you plow through an intersection. And it's amazing how much difference that make. Like you can free mouse look while you're steering. Like imagine how different that feels when you can see the inside of the vehicle that you're in. And it kind of changed my entire perception of how this worked. And I don't know if I can recommend the game. It's $40, but play the demo. It's very different from other driving simulators. And
You know what
also
we have to do
gorgeous.
now? You know what you have to do?
What?
You have to
What's
get a
that?
track IR and hook that up so that you can look around by turning your head.
I Oculus
was
Rift.
thinking, I was definitely,
And
I'm
then
serious,
drive
while I
with an
was playing,
Oculus Rift.
I was actually, while I was playing this, I was like, this game would be amazing with Oculus Rift because you could be driving while moving your head, like in a real car, because that's the big thing
No,
that
no, no.
hamstrings you in a sim.
No, that's Track IR. Oculus Rift is that great big like controller that they came out with that like has no third party support at all. That's
No,
like
Oculus Rift is the
it's
goggles. The 3D goggles.
No. This is that's 3D goggles. No, I'm pretty sure that Oculus Rift is that great big like spherical thing that's attached to like three
No.
robot arms, isn't it?
No, I've
No,
been
no.
following the Rift. You probably you're mixing it up with something with a similar name. I've been following the Oculus Rift since basically John Carmack tweeted about it.
Huh.
It's a big visor.
Yeah,
You're right.
it's a 3D
Huh.
visor. Yeah.
What was it that what was that
Yeah,
called?
now I want to know what you were talking about because that sounds interesting or funny.
It sounded like
It
were you
had a
describing
name
like a
like
new
that.
version of Rob or something?
You know what? It fucking looked like it sometimes.
Okay, well, oh, go.
No, I was just gonna joke about was it the recording booth for the LA Noire stuff where you stick your head in, but
No.
Anyway, Euro Truck Simulator 2013. Amazingly gorgeous. You get to see European flag. It's not actually all of Europe. This is not a Google Map version of Europe. This is a great. This is like what GTA is to New York. This scaled down, compressed of all the landmarks kind of place. Interesting to see. Great. You can drive around and in a few hours see most of Europe. Gorgeous. Try the demo. It's very different. If you're looking for different, I highly recommend it. I had a lot of fun. And that's it for that.
The worst part about this is that I know the first comment on this diecast is going to be, "Oh, Josh, you're thinking of this other thing," with a
Yes,
complete
I
link to the
know.
store page and everything. I'm going to feel like a dumbass.
I am sorry, Josh. And since we're done with what everybody's playing this week, you know what it's time for. It's time for the horrible SimCity story of the week.
Right, yes.
Chris, actually, you are the one that sent me the story. Can you summarize it for us?
Which one? There are two this week, I thought.
Oh, I was talking about the Nissan
We're
Leaf
not talking about the
Sword.
story where Polygon updated their score of SimCity again to reflect some bullshit that presumably matters to Polygon and the 15 people who still credit it as a respectable news source. But no, we're talking about the other thing, the thing that they did.
So, yes, Polygon did update their score again, but basically they released, EA released a new pack of DLC for SimCity, and right alongside finally turning Cheetah Mode back on, by the way. And it is basically a Nissan Leaf charging station, so you can charge all those electric cars that you have in your town that thus far have gone for 100 feet and then left, run out of battery life and just immediately died and have been left stranded on your roadways. You can actually charge them now, and they don't just die for no reason.
Wait, is that actually a thing
no,
it should have
been,
the game?
No.
You know, in case you wanted more traffic problems.
No, but...
Right, but... Yeah, tell them about the gameplay aspect of this charging station.
Well, the gameplay aspect is that it's more or less broken. It's a charging station that, of all things, takes up no electricity. It generates no sewage. It generates no garbage. And as soon as you plop it down, it both makes any drivers that use it exceptionally happy, and it also spreads happiness around the area. And... So basically you have this infinite happiness generating machine that has no downsides whatsoever. And that's kind of game breaking to begin with, but the whole thing is like branded in bright red letters with the Nissan logo. And it, when you combine those two things, it becomes this weird kind of ludic propaganda of like, see, put Nissan things and your town is happy now. Yay! And
it's just, yeah. It's especially offensive in a game called Sim City. This is a simulation, and here we have a car and an electric car charging station that uses not a single jolt of electricity.
Well,
not,
you know,
right.
what sort of
totalitarian revisionist physics is it like? Like, that's the sort of thing that like a dictatorship would post in their newspaper. Like, you know, we put these
charging stations.
They cause no electricity. It's the sort
well,
of thing where you have
because,
no respect.
That's because electric cars are powered by eldritch abominations. That's why the oil companies have been trying to kill them. They're looking out for us.
It's the sort of thing where you have no respect for the person the message is directed to, that they would be able to see through such a transparent bullshit attempt at propaganda.
It's the Dilbert joke. You don't even have enough respect to me for me to come up with a plausible lie. Yeah, it does have that, and I wonder if this isn't something that Nissan specifically requested, because the one thing that they did not want was for you to throw in a charging station that had some plausible level of drain, realize, oops, electric cars are really hitting my power grid, and then you drop down a coal plant to power the thing, and then you, and then suddenly a light bulb comes on over your head. That's probably what Nissan feared most.
It should be noted that this isn't the first time that EA has done things like this. Shortly after The Sims 3 launched, they released a DLC for a Toyota Prius that was, I believe, also free or maybe part of a patch. But either way, it's not quite as flagrant, but it is a... In real life, the Prius is a rather expensive, I think, like a $30,000 car. And in The Sims, you have cars that cost 70, 60, 50, 40,000 simoleons. In The Sims 3, the Prius is $5,000, which prices it very comfortably as a mid-range car in the game, even though in real life it's much more expensive than that. And again, it's that sort of thing where... Mechanics do carry meaning, and mechanics do give messages, and it is, I don't want to say false advertising, but certainly a creepy way to make the product look better than it actually is in real life, whether that's infinite happiness charging stations that generate no waste, or if it's a car that's far more affordable than it might actually be in real life.
Yeah, and it does smack of just... sliminess, and for it to go in a simulation game, that really rubs me raw. If they gave you, it's basically a cheat item, and if there was a driving, let's say Grand Theft Auto, and they gave you a Nissan Leaf, and it was, you know, faster than the other cars, and better and more durable, I would say, alright, they want you to use their little branded thing, and they want to reward you for that, and that's fine. The game isn't about simulating cars. But this is like, having a Nissan Leaf be faster than a Formula One car in Gran Turismo, which is supposed, you know, people come here for the simulation. This is something that you should not be screwing around with to spread a message. And taken in with all, well, go ahead.
Oh, well, is that even good? Advertising is the thing. Advertising is about making, is about providing half of a lie. It is about providing enough plausibility that the lines are swallowed along with it. You know, you don't say like, oh yeah, the Nissan charging stations require zero power. There are no possible negative downsides. You know, you get them for free, like with your groceries on weekends. They're really super cheap and affordable, environmentally safe guys. You know, no, because nobody's going to buy that. What you do is you make the energy drain about a third of what it would actually be, and people are like, oh, wow, these things don't take very much power.
That would be much smarter propaganda. So this is even dumb, lame, game-breaking propaganda in service of putting a Nissan-branded advertisement that, by the way, the word Nissan, you can see when you zoom way out, you can see it from pretty high up over the ceiling, city. Over the ceiling. I'll try and see. I'll see if I can find a screenshot of it, but it is kind of silly. Just how ridiculous, how blatant it is. So that's the bad SimCity news this week.
It well, I will free, say though, one more thing.
At least they're not charging you for it.
I feel like, maybe I'm overreaching a little bit with this theory here, but this is almost so blatant that I suspect, I don't think this was done like as a form of satire or protest per se by the people involved with the SimCity project. I think it's more a matter of they just don't care anymore. They're like, nobody likes our game, it's always getting worse, you know, there's bad news every week, and now the mandate is to put in propaganda for Nissan as our next free DLC instead of fixing all the fucking problems with the game. You know what? We're just gonna half-ass this. They want propaganda? Okay, they're free, there are giant signs, and they make everybody happy. Have fun,
and
game
the
media.
Nissan vehicles. and the Nissan vehicles produce ice cream when you drive them.
Oh, that was... go ahead, Josh.
I feel like that's probably more of just like someone higher up the corporate chain dictating, like, okay, you have to put this in the game, and it can't have any downsides because we don't want to piss off Nissan.
I'm looking up the cost of the Nissan Leaf now, and it's $21,000. And in the game's PR announcement, DLC announcement thing, they make a point of saying that Sims of all economic classes will be driving the Leaf as soon as you place the charging station down in your world, which means whether you're a small town with just like a podunk gas station and a donut shop and that's all you have, or you're a thriving metropolis, every single person of every economic background will be driving a $21,000 car. And again, creepy.
Yeah. All right, so does anybody want to take bets that we will get to the next podcast and not have any more horrible SimCity news?
No bets.
it's either going to be this coming week or the week after. I think they're reaching a point where there's nothing new. I mean, it's not going to be a good game, but I think we're reaching a point where there's not going to be another crippling, horrible disaster.
I've been thinking that, Chris, for a month now.
And not only do I agree with you, I agreed with you every week previous to this one.
Yeah. All right, let's not give SimCity any more time. Let's talk about Thief 4 and all of the various news that's coming out regarding Thief 4. There's a trailer, there have been some previews, there have been some interviews. Boy, it would be really nice if I had these links in order. But just thoughts. What's your reaction to all this Thief 4 news?
Anyway. Well, point of order, Seamus. It's not Thief 4 anymore. It's Thief. Just Thief. Real great.
Okay,
real,
yeah, before we get this started, this is something that's really I'm curious about, is what are we going to do? We're doing this with Tomb Raider. We're doing this with Thief. We're doing this with SimCity. What are we going to do when it's time for another sequel? Are we going to make another Tomb Raider 2? Or
We've been doing
three,
this with movies
two
for
subtitles.
Decades. I mean,
they do subtitles. That's what they do.
All right, fair enough. That's fine. I was just curious how this was, because that is. I mean, it's one thing to have two different games with the same base name, but to have the same number after it is confusing.
Well,
thing is, I'm going to make a guess here. Chris is about to talk about how the fact that naming things serially is a gaming unique phenomenon that will probably be phased out.
No, I was going to say that if you're doing anything with like traditional text writing, prose, you would put in parentheses the year of the release, and that would allow you to know which Tomb Raider 2 you're referring to.
All right.
Again, we've been doing this with movies for decades, so, I mean, and...
Yeah.
It's kind of new for video games because we haven't been around as long, but...
Still, like, can't wait for them to make, you know, Doom and Quake and... Age of Empires.
Isn't Doom 4 in trouble? I mean, like, not that Doom 4 was not in trouble ever.
Yeah,
I'm hearing bad things that the Doom 4 team is in trouble, and I didn't follow up on those, so I can't comment on it now, but I saw bad headlines.
Yeah, there was the whole Kotaku article about, and Bethesda confirmed it, that basically the game was something like 3 years in production and has recently been completely scrapped and is now starting over, and also any plans they had for Rage 2 have been completely scrapped as well, and it
that
is
doesn't
not
sound
in a
familiar.
Good place with Bethesda.
So that's awesome. You bought up id Software, the very last of the independent developers. And they were profitable, and they were doing fine, and you bought them, and pretty much the first game you tried to make with them, you drove into the ground. That's
well,
amazing.
Okay.
Even
I mean,
EA hasn't been that bad.
Let's be fair. What is Doom now? I mean, in 2013, what is Doom? I mean...
That's just it.
Yeah. People have an idea about
Doom 1
and Doom
2. You boil the water, you pour the potatoes.
But Doom 3 was completely different from those games, and apparently not very good from what I've heard about it. So, I mean, what kind of shooter is Doom 4 even supposed to be now?
If you read the Kotaku article about what it was a game very kind of like Doom 3 was, where it had horror, surprise, pop-out elements, and some other creepy elements in it, but then also a lot of Call of Duty style set piece. They're blowing up Earth. Oh no, some kid died. Sort of stuff.
Oh,
and
thank you, Bethesda. Shit, didn't want to see that. That sounds
Please
wretched.
Continue your sensible culling of bad ideas.
Is there any other terrible shit you could buy up so it'll disappear forever?
Well, apparently that whole project has been scrapped, and now they're trying to figure out what Doom is. And according to the Kotaku article, and I'll give it a Seamus to link later, basically, John Carmack got up after a big speech by everyone, was like, "What does Doom mean to you?" And Carmack basically got up and said, "Look, Doom means two things, shotguns and demons," and then sat down, and that was basically all he really wanted out of the game. And so I don't know if they really have a meaningful direction or if they're really taking it to heart. I don't know if they're going with anything, you know, serious Sammy, or if they're going with, you know, they're going back to that sort of horror element. I don't know what they're planning at this point, but basically everything they had planned was this big, terrible, everything you would expect a AAA game, Doom, in 2013 to be, has been scrapped. So the project's in trouble. It's on thin ice with Bethesda, and yay.
Look, if anyone ever asks me, what do you want from a Doom game, I can answer that in two extremely ironic words. A soul.
Oh, I thought you were going to say, I don't.
Good choice. No, it's actually not a bad idea. Like that's what makes Doom 1 and Doom 2 work so well, is that you could really get a sense of what the games were about. They were about this really sense of strong weapons and heavy metal music, and all of the art was like heavy metal inspired, and with maybe vague tints of H.R. Giger and a little bit of Lovecraft, but it did have a soul, and I think Doom 3 didn't. I think Doom 3 was, hey, look at our fancy light engine, and also monster closets that don't have any explanation, and things pop out of them.
Which does make me wonder if Carmack has perhaps become a bit too focused on the tech side to the detriment of, like, the design side of the game.
He's even aware... It's true, and I think he's even aware of it. Even getting Doom 3 made caused some strife within the company. I think somebody was fired over their argument over making Doom 3. Somebody didn't want to make it. Other people did want to make it. There are factions within id that want to do more artistic stuff, and then there are the guys that are like, look, we're the guys that make shotguns and demon games. We should stick to that. That's our wheelhouse. That's what we need to do. And it may be that their biggest problem is that they can't decide between the two. That they're trying to please both groups, and we're winding up with these tepid games that don't seem to please either.
We were talking about Thief, right?
Yeah.
How did we get to
Well, you? I'm glad we got how off on that tangent, because I have nothing to say about Thief 4.
The only thing I have to say is that we have all these tiny little bits of news, and they're all bad in minor ways.
Yeah.
Right.
It's not that... Like, on one hand, you have this fantastic pedigree of is it... Square Enix, or Eidos Montreal, is that who's developing?
I believe so, but I don't have it in front of me. I want to say Eidos Montreal, I think.
Yeah,
but maybe I'm
yeah.
Square Enix, Eidos Montreal, yeah. Which would go some way towards explaining what Garrett looks like now.
Well, I mean, it's the Human Revolution team, basically. That's the core team, from what I understand. And it's... that's a really strong pedigree, and I loved what they did with Human Revolution, but at the same time, I keep hearing things that make me go back and forth. On one hand, it's like, hey, you can beat the game without killing anybody, as opposed to, say, Dishonored. Screw you, Dishonored. And then they'll turn around and say, yeah, but you can punch guys, and you'll see their bones break in slow motion. And it's like, yeah, that's not really the Thief I know. And then they'll go back and say, you know, Garrett's back, and he's sneaking around, and he's slinking in the shadows, and it's all about stealing things, and not really about killing dudes, and he's even got his missing eye, and that's all great. And then they'll turn around and also say, yeah, but the steampunk's gone, and a lot of the magic's gone, and that makes no sense. Why is he missing an eye if all the magic crap's gone? And because
I really wish they'd come out as to whether this is a remake or a reimagining or just a sequel.
My biggest worry with this, there's an interview, and I stupidly did not send this link to the rest of you guys, so I don't know if you saw this one or not. But there was an interview where they talked about why they're not using Stephen Russell as the voice of Garrett.
But they're using Elias Tofexis.
Sutherland?
I don't think so. I think
oh, no, that's Solid Snake. That's Solid Snake. Sorry.
Wait, what reason did they have for not keeping the old voice actor?
Oh, my goodness.
Okay. Boss?
They want full body, full performance capture, your face, your voice, and your body all captured in the same performance.
What?
For a first-person Thief game. And Stephen Russell is, like, 50. He's not going to be jumping around a mocap studio doing his own stunts. You know,
Wait,
there's going to be cutscenes.
Fucking Garrett!
I know! They are literally saying, we don't want to use this incredibly talented voice actor because he can't do his own stunts for a Thief game.
Garrett needs to do three things. Stand in the shadows, move very slowly, and make sort of snide, snarky remarks to himself.
Exactly. So what are these cutscenes going to have? Why are we having lavishly... I mean, remember the blow-up that we had with L.A. Noire, where their face capture technology, as awesome as it looked, was also ridiculously expensive. And now we're going even one further, where we're going to have full body capture and face capture and voice capture. And is this something that anybody wants? Is this something that's going
to
sell games?
This
I never
is not
looked
the first
at a Thief
game to
game.
Do this.
Oh, okay. Well, still, this is not something that I think is all important to a Thief game,
yeah.
Especially. What's going to
I mean,
be these
it could be
scenes?
It could work really well for a game where you have, like, a constant companion, like Bioshock Infinite with Booker and Elizabeth.
Oh.
And they decided to do it with that. That could work pretty well.
But
turns out they
made
based around escort quests.
But I mean, they didn't. Booker or Elizabeth had a different body model as and a voice
Right,
actor,
right. And
Tomb Raider did the same
I'm
thing.
not even sure they did any face capture for the animations of the face at all, because I mean it's a somewhat cartoony art style as BioShock has always had. But the thing with Thief is like, no, you're alone running around stealing stuff in the shadows, so why do we need this if it's a first person game?
And remember, the earlier games had those wonderfully, like, hand-drawn. Like, it was basically a slideshow. You could make it in, like, Windows Movie Maker circa 19... or, like, 2004. Like, just, like, pan over some hand-drawn images. You're done in an afternoon, and it cost you $100.
Like, is Thief 4 a stealth Metal Gear Solid crossover? Are we going to have 9 hours of cutscenes or something?
That's what I'm afraid of, and if this much money is being put into the cutscenes, which nobody plays Thief for the cutscenes, not that they shouldn't have it at all or that there shouldn't be a story, but that why is so much of the budget going to that particular feature?
I guess
Again,
the
it
question
doesn't mean the game will be terrible, but it's worrisome.
Exactly. We're not saying, oh no, they have cutscenes where things happen, or no, oh no, Garrett might move around, or oh no, there might be characters and dialogue. We're saying, what kind of game are they making? Like, if this is what like they're talking about, what they're showing you, where they're placing their priorities, what kind of game did they start making when they set out to make a Thief game? Because it's not looking like any of the Thief games we've seen so far, and in a lot of ways that sacrifice things that we do recognize. For example, the fucking voice of Garrett in the previous three games.
Where that was his entire character. And what's going to happen? I am actually worried about what will happen in these cutscenes. What I'm very much afraid of is I'm going to sneak through this building without being seen, without anybody even knowing I was there, and then I'm going to have a cutscene where I shank two dudes, jump through a window, and make a bunch of noise, and get seen by everybody. Basically a cutscene where I stop acting like the character I've been trying to pilot. And the game designers are telling me, no, actually, you should be just shanking people as you go through the game. That's my worry.
The other thing that worries me is that, the thing about Garrett's voice actor in the previous games was, not only was he very good and did he absolutely nail the tone of the character in a way, like, frankly, a lot of VoIP games from that era did not have that good voice acting. Like, they did
Right.
not have. So this isn't even a nostalgia thing, it's just, it really was particularly good. But most of the game is Garrett narrating to himself. He talks about his jobs as if it was a journal entry in the cutscenes that tell you what you have to do. He talks to himself about objectives updating or like things that he spots or hints for the players. He's his own companion. He's your companion. Having a different voice for that, especially when the original voice was actually kind of distinctive in a way. I mean, he was just a gravelly dude, I guess, but like there was a kind of wit and charm to it. And having that replaced with another voice is kind of going to feel like, I don't know. It will feel very jarring, I'm afraid.
I'm calling it right now. You're gonna the game is gonna be you're gonna spend like an hour sneaking into a highly defended like mansion or castle or whatever. Get to the place you have to be, to the room that has all the stuff in it that you need to steal, and you'll have an extremely high definition, super motion captured cutscene where you talk to Wesker for 5 minutes.
Well, that's sort of what I'm picturing too, and that's what concerns me. And I really love what Rutskarn said, because, Garrett really is your companion. It doesn't feel like you are Garrett, Master Thief. It feels like you're a Master Thief, and Garrett's sort of like your dude friend sitting next to you, commenting on everything you do. And it I love the way that that felt, and the fact that they're going away from having that. The fact that they're going away from having a voice actor that could be 50 years old and be that sort of guy that sits next to you and gives you one-liners while you play, and instead are saying that they need a guy who can do crazy stunts and do his own stunts and do his own voice acting and do facial capture stuff, means that they're really moving into like this thing where it's like, like Josh was saying, you're going to do this thief bit, and then there's going to be a story bit where it's a cutscene, and it's all very cinematic, and then you're going to have another little thief bit, and it's Thief's levels, I mean, we were talking about this in spoiler warning earlier last week, but Thief's levels were huge and uninterrupted, and your only companion was sort of your own internal dialogue. And here it feels like it's going to be, your gameplay is going to be little tiny chunks of sneaking around guards so that you can reach whatever, you know, MacGuffin that Garrett needs to activate a plot sequence where he gets betrayed, or he gets the revenge, or he gets angry, and we're going to have a lot of third-person external camera stuff, and it's going to be like, it's going to feel like all of the worst parts of Human Revolution, where you would sneak into a base and then have a plot stupidity thing happen, where I'll sneak up to, what was her name? The bad lady?
Zhao.
Oh, fuck.
Yeah, Zhao.
Yeah,
you'll sneak up into Zhao's base,
which they never pronounce correctly in the game, by the way.
Well, it's like Maggie Chow from the first game. If you didn't have the ability to shoot her as soon as you saw her.
Exactly. I mean, that's another great example. Is sort of. I mean, you see that with Deus Ex going from what we had, where it was all very ludic and very game based, to having more cutscene stupidity and that sort of thing. But a lot of that was outsourced, and a lot of that was given to other teams, and so whatever. Here it feels like that's sort of more core to the design. Like, everything they've announced has been very much, oh yeah, we have this idea for sneaking around and maybe punching guys' bones out when you have to, but then we're going to give you this cutscene that has all this really expensive voice animation, and we fired the other guy because screw him, because we need this fancy stuff. And that scares me.
Sacrificing something we definitely wanted for something that we don't see the value of definitely makes it sound like they have their heart in the wrong place. Okay. Mailbag time. We're finally going to answer some of these friggin'... Yeah, I know, right?
But no, wait, but LucasArts.
All right.
I mean, we could talk about this real fast.
We mentioned... Okay, here's why I was skipping LucasArts. We brought it up before the show, and nobody had anything to say. And I was like, oh. Okay.
I mean, it's kind of important. I mean, I spent a lot of time playing Star Wars games, especially when I was younger. And of course, LucasArts has that long... Well... That history
X-Wing
back in the day of being
Fighter.
Being all those good LucasArts scum adventure games. I mean, where did Monkey Island come from? So LucasArts is being dissolved, and Disney has released a statement saying that they are switching to licensing the IP out to other game developers. So they're basically killing the internal development, which is really interesting, because I didn't realize that LucasArts still did internal development, or had been doing internal development for the past 20 years.
Well, I mean, they're not being dissolved proper. I mean, you're going to still see the LucasArts logo on games, but it's going to be games
Are
that
you?
Disney licensed Star Wars out to. You know, you're going to see it on your Telltale Star Wars games. You're going to see it on if they sell the 1313 property that they've, probably sunk $30 million into.
Wait, back up. There's Telltale Star Wars games?
Traveler's Tale.
Telltale Star
confused.
Wars game. You play
I was
a Jedi
say.
Who takes a walk through the Mos Eisley Cantina and talks to the people there.
Traveler's
Tale. One of them.
The Lego guy. If you,
I see.
You're still going to see the LucasArts logo. So the company itself isn't being dissolved, but it's basically being turned into an IP handling company that basically licenses out.
Fired 300 people. So.
Well, yes. I mean, it's a devastating loss, and it still basically is the final closure to something that's been going on for the past 10 years, which is LucasArts no longer actually making games. LucasArts just selling Star Wars IPs and Indiana Jones IPs to whoever wants to make those sorts of games.
But yeah, again, I mean, like, I'm trying to, I'm thinking over the long list of Star Wars games, and I'm trying to think of ones that were actually developed in-house. I mean, the LucasArts did the adventure games, but that was pretty much over by the early 90s. The X-Wing games were totally games, KOTOR was BioWare, obviously, Lots of late 90s.
What about the Jedi Knight games?
Fails.
Republic
I think
Mando.
Dark Forces 1 was in-house, but I think Jedi
Raven
Knight
Software.
was a different. Yeah, Jedi Outcast was Raven Software. I think Jedi Knight was also outsourced to someone, although I don't remember who. That might have been in-house.
So I'm looking at the Wikipedia list of games made by LucasArts, and this is Wikipedia, so take it with a grain of salt the size of the moon. But it looks like the last game that LucasArts that had a hand in development with that actually got published was Force Unleashed 2, but that was one of
Yeah.
three developers. And the last game fully made by LucasArts from the ground up was Lucidity, which was that cute little puzzle platformer. Before that, it was, and that was in 2008 or 2009. Before that, it was Star Wars Republic Commando in 2005. So
Yeah.
they've had basically like three games in the past 10 years, and none of them have been blockbusters.
I mean, this has pretty much been the modus operandi for LucasArts for years, is hand it off to experienced developers to make their own games. I mean, that's where all the memorable Star Wars games have really come from. So I don't know. I mean, it's awful that the company got like that so many people are getting fired, but at the same time, it's not going to make much of a difference because this is what LucasArts has been doing. I mean, I guess 1313 was actually in-house development, which I didn't know, and may or may not be canceled now.
Well, it sounds like it's canceled internally, but it wouldn't surprise me if we find out that it gets sold to some other studio,
Yeah,
six
that
months
there
from now.
was like someone was like one of the former LucasArts employees was telling Kotaku that they might be like that 1313 might be handed off to some other outside developer. So it might not die, and maybe it'll get a better name.
Do you remember the story we heard a few weeks ago? Like, just a couple months ago, they released a bunch of screenshots for 1313, and sort of just stirred the water from a press perspective. Do you remember this? No, nobody remembers this. It was the first time I'd ever heard of the game. I mean, it had been in development and people had been whispering about it, but all of a sudden there's a little story and screenshots and, oh, here's the website and everything, and people started talking about release dates and, in another year or whatever. I thought, oh, interesting. And then here we are just like 3 months later and it's canceled. And I wonder if that whole marketing thing was testing the waters to see if people were just going to go crazy for this, or if they were like, oh, yeah, that. I wonder if they were sort of deciding
I
what to
can't
do with it.
imagine that's the case for two reasons. One, the fact that nobody knew about the LucasArts merger until it was officially announced meant that they kept that
Right.
really under wraps. And the other thing is that Disney historically has the whole reason they're shutting this thing down, they have no idea how to handle video games. Disney is terrible at interactive entertainment. Just
Yeah,
about every
they.
foray they've ever tried has been a failure. Epic Mickey, occasionally they do something smart like license out things to Capcom, but that's the whole
Yeah,
point.
do
That's when
Kingdom Hearts.
they see success, is when they say, "Hey, someone who knows video games, make video games for us." Any of their internal dev studios, anytime they've owned production, has been terrible for them, and it has failed every time, and they really just don't get it. So I can't imagine they were like, "Hey, we're gonna buy you. You guys should really figure out if this 1313 thing is an important thing." I can't see that happening.
Yeah, I'd say like unless there was other problems in 1313 development, I'd say it's probably a pretty safe bet that it'll be sent off to some other publisher.
Yeah, I mean, it didn't look offensively bad. It's got Star Wars licensing, which is always at least a reasonable draw. I mean, even if it's a mediocre, middle-of-the-road first-person shooter that's sort of like Star Wars Elite or whatever it was that let you be a clone trooper. It'll make some money. It's
I think
better to,
it was First Assault or something like that was what it was. I don't know.
You shot the Wookiee bow. That's all I remember.
I've ever since the prequels came out, I have started to hate Star Wars, and it doesn't help that the expanded universe is pretty awful at this point too. So there's not a whole lot for me to look at and say, hey, that's a pretty cool part of Star Wars. I've just been waiting for 10 years for remakes and or sequels to the X-Wing series.
Well, that's the real big thing with the closure of LucasArts, though, and that's what scares everybody. What does this mean for the future of Disney giving a crap about any of the myriad of gamer-beloved IPs that they do not at all care about? This basically throws things like Monkey Island, Grim Fandango, and others into this, like, you thought it was hard to get them out of Lucas. Imagine them being a part of Disney where Disney does not care. Now, maybe Disney will be more open about it. Maybe they really are more excited about, you know, licensing IPs to third parties. And hey, yeah, we're not going to do anything with Grim Fandango. Freaking take it. Yeah, you're give us $2 million and you can do whatever you want. But it's just as likely that Disney will be even worse and say, yeah, that's our IP. We own that. Don't touch that. Don't even look at it. We'll do it when we figure out what to do with it.
Yeah,
it's like when your
asshole
cousin has a bunch of toys that are like 4 years too young for him, but he won't let you play with them.
I'm the eldest of...
Well, that one was strangely
I'm
personal.
The eldest of all of my cousins,
fucking
so... I am the eldest of my generation in my entire extended family, at least on my dad's side.
Yes, Josh, I'm still bitter because Josh wouldn't give me his toys.
Yep, that was it. Rutskar and I are actually related. No, I'd like to be optimistic about this and say that this is Disney saying that they're just going to be pretty laissez-faire about all this and just kind of let developers do what they want with the IP and see if they can actually manage to make money. But at the same time, it's super huge conglomerate Disney, so... Eh.
Okay, now let's do the mailbag.
Mailbag.
This is the stuff sent to diecast@seamusyoung.com. First up, I have an email from Josh. You have a couple of mails, right?
Yeah. I'm looking over them, trying to figure out which ones I want to put in here.
We have them randomly being sent to different cast members.
Yeah.
So
do you not have the emails that I have? Does nobody have all of the emails? Excellent. Okay.
Nobody has all.
This
yes,
is a great system
it's
we've got
chaos.
Here.
Yes, this is perfect. Very professional. Paul asks, how do you decide what is a good game? What are the figures of merit? What are their weights? Wow, this is a big question. This is like an episode. We can't do this as a mailbag.
I don't know. Did I like it? Was it after I was like, huh? Yeah. Or was it like,
you know,
or was it like,
you know what? You know what? The weird thing for me is that it isn't always the games that are good that I talk about. Games have to be either on one end of the spectrum or the other, either wonderful or horrible before I talk about them. So, to be a good game, it isn't really enough to get talked about for me. Like, I guess I can't reference a lot of games that I've played that I thought were, oh, that's good. Like, I never bothered to write about them, and I barely remember them now. So, I don't know what kind of metric I would use. Nothing annoys me or pisses me off.
I actually missed the question entirely because I was reading my own emails.
How do you define a good game?
How do I do... Okay. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there's different kinds of good games.
Yeah. I mean, if the budget was above $100 million.
Good in the same... That's yeah, yeah,
how
that's
many
it.
Polygon?
Okay, see, the Old Republic was the best game ever. All right, we saw it.
Yeah,
question people... answered. Thank you for writing in.
Josh, you do the next one.
Well, I didn't get to go.
Oh, you have a... Wait. Oh, you have an answer to this? Yeah, go for it.
Well, not a great answer, but I don't know. In terms of what makes... In terms of what makes a game good, I think it really depends on the game, and it's not even... That sounds kind of wishy-washy, but in a way it isn't. You have to approach the game on the game's terms. What is the game trying to be? What does it want to be? What does it present itself as? And then what does it actually do? And if it's a game that really wants to be serious and important and then ends up spending most of its time just being sort of generic shooter wankery, it's not a very good game. If it's a game that really wants to...
Do you
to
have
be
a
bold,
recent example of that? Do you have any
don't,
recent...
Don't, not now. No.
Okay, go ahead.
But if it's a game that really wants... If it's a game that sort of wants to engage you intellectually and does, then I think you could argue it succeeds, even if it might fail in some small ways. If it's a game that wants to be more about its systems, and you know, Serious Sam is the dumbest game I've ever played, but I love it because it knows what it's about. It is about shooting a bunch of monsters in the face and crowd control and powerful weapons, and it doesn't make any pretense about being anything else. If you approach a game on its own terms and really look at what it's trying to say and do and judge whether it succeeds at that and whether that itself is a noble goal. I mean, if it's a terribly racist or horrible or offensive game, that's a different story altogether. I mean, but the point is, you know, if a game achieves something beautiful, whether that's systems or intellectual stimulation or telling a story, if it achieves what it's trying to do, I think that's a good game. And I don't care what that thing is.
Yeah, it's not really reasonable to complain that Super Hexagon does not have an engaging narrative.
It needs fully mo-capped cutscenes. Full performance capture.
Fully mo-capped hexagons.
So Josh, can you take the next email?
Yeah, okay. Yosef has a couple questions. He says, "Hi, longtime reader and a fan here with a few questions. One, what kind of setup does Josh have for streaming and recording? Spoiler warning, software, hardware, how did it evolve over the years?" Oh, Jesus. My setup is some kind of eldritch abomination created by stringing together a bunch of components that aren't designed to work together to do something they were never meant to do. I use Livestream to stream games while recording them with Fraps, while recording audio with Ventrilo, and for the podcast with Audacity. And that all I've somehow managed to get that all to work together in some way, that seems to work consistently, and I'm not I sometimes just I think about it and I go, how the fuck did I ever manage that? It is there are a lot of points where it can totally fail, and it's remarkable that it doesn't fail more often. That said, in the time since 2009, when we were talking about doing this for the first time, and now, like, streaming has kind of just exploded. Like, so many people are doing live streams of games and whatnot, that has significantly improved the tools available to do what we want to do. So, I mean, it's gotten kind of easier and more reasonable
It's
since then,
yeah, but it's still a Rube. It's
but
still a Rube Goldberg contraption. It
it is
still has
very
many moving parts.
much, yeah. It's like a clock made of paper mache. Second
Okay.
question,
Okay.
if you don't mind if I read the rest of this,
Go for it.
these are pretty short ones. This may be a cultural phenomenon, but why do you hate puns? And the answer is, well, we don't hate puns, we just hate Rutskarn.
Yeah,
Yes.
I'm totally
It's
for puns.
not the person saying it, it's well, no, it's the person saying it and what they stand for more than the form itself.
Well, the problem is that puns are basically one step above miming on the comedy pantheon. So that's really the problem.
You know, I once, like,
I don't
there's a
think that's
cracked
true. I don't
article.
think I'd put it above.
There's a cracked article where, like, John Cheese or someone was talking about puns, and they said something like, you know, the gist of it was like, you know, you see pun threads all the time. Why, you guys really need to learn that everyone hates you for doing this. Puns aren't funny. You know, somebody really needed to let you know this at some point. I was like, so why do you think they do them then if they don't think it's funny?
Yeah.
Where do you think the enjoyment's coming from? Do you think this is an exercise in absolute groupthink, or do you think that maybe they think it's funny and you don't?
I think they think that it's funny that he gets mad at it.
Well, that's the other thing. I am twice as likely to pun if I think that someone is going to take offense.
Well, maybe that's why puns are funny. It's not so. It's more of a sadist thing of torturing people who hear the pun than the humor in the pun itself.
I actually can't explain why I enjoy them, because the thing is, I love it when people make good puns. And I do have actually a surprisingly, like, you guys think of my thing of me as just like, oh, you know, if he sees a pun, I'll just go for it. The thing is, I'm actually kind of a pun snob. Like, when I see, like, a newspaper headline that has a pun in it, most of the time it's going to drive me fucking insane. Like, the absolute worst thing in the world for me is a review score pun. Like, a review of Titanic, like, Titanic sinks, or this film doesn't hit the
Yeah.
iceberg.
Well, I think the thing to bring away from this is that no matter how evil I am, Rutskarn is just as evil or more.
For the pun to be
That's
good, it
fair.
has to be unexpected. That's where the humor comes from.
And the last bit here, directed specifically at you, Seamus, I think, and maybe Rutskarn. I've recently started a gaming blog myself. Any advice you could give me would be greatly appreciated, which is a pretty open question.
Write what you love. That's it. Write what you love.
Yeah, also do it a lot so you get better
Yeah.
quickly. I mean,
Yeah,
I
if you want some examples of crappy writing, go back in my archives to 2006, and you will see like a lot of really shallow analysis of a game. In fact, the one I linked to the other day was like Fear, and I was like, oh yeah, I played this game, and I liked the environments, and the graphics were good, and the gunplay was okay, and the AI was good, but I didn't like the cutscenes, and the voice acting was also good. And it was like this Consumer Reports style
Which
review. All I
makes
needed to
you
do.
just as good as most professional reviewers.
Well, really, I mean, that's something like I scorn now. Like, who cares about this laundry list of features and how you feel about each of them? Now I want to talk about, like, well, what worked and what didn't and what's new and what's different. And, like, you don't, when you have a conversation with somebody after a movie, you don't sit down, you know, the two of you go to Del Taco, you sit there with your food and you're like, okay, well, what did you think of the cinematography? And what did you think of the audio? And what about the score? And just go through this laundry list of stuff, of each possible feature. You know, you talk about whatever was interesting in the movie or how it made you think or feel. You don't list each of its physical attributes. So yeah, I scorn that type of thing now, and I look back on those old posts and like, oh, that's really weird. So instead of being shaped by, you know, it's because I read too many reviews, and that's what I thought you were supposed to do. So don't let yourself be defined by what you think is expected. Write whatever you think is interesting. If you think it's interesting, somebody else out there is probably a freak just like you are, and they will be like, oh, wow, here's somebody that really speaks to me. And then you'll have followers. That's
Yes.
my advice.
And Seamus's earlier advice about write what you love is actually a really good one. That's something that I've recently had to learn for myself. I got into a cycle on my site where I was writing Skyrim Let's Play because at this point I guess I felt like I was obligated to do Let's Plays of all the Elder Scrolls games. That's what people
Right,
liked.
because your Morrowind one you loved doing and it was really funny. I'll link that in the show notes. It was wonderful, your Morrowind. It made me laugh so often. It was really excellent stuff.
Right, and it was a lot of fun to do. And I but you know, for various reasons that I won't go into because it's beyond the purview of answering this question, I didn't like doing Skyrim as much. It just wasn't lending itself well. The short version is I wasn't really telling my own story. I was just relating the story of what happens in Skyrim and trying to make it funny, and it often just
Yeah.
there wasn't anything to work with. So I wasn't writing it because I didn't want to, and I kept putting it off and postponing it. And because I was postponing writing that, I didn't want to come to the site and post something else and like come in empty-handed, so I didn't post anything. So my site's been a ghost town for an embarrassingly long time, and now I'm going to try to fix that, try to figure out what I do want to write. So don't let that happen to you, I guess.
And if writing what you love doesn't work, you can always just find someone with a far more successful blog, make friends with them, and then hijack it.
Yes.
Bastards.
Well, I think it's not just writing what you love, although I think that's critical to it. I agree with Seamus and I agree with Rutskar, and everything they've said has rung true. I think more than anything, though, you need to find why you play games and why you enjoy them and write about that. It's not just what you love. It's not just, I like Pokemon games. I'm going to write all my Pokemon down on a list. It's you need to find out not just what games you love. Don't just write about what you love. Write why you love it. Write about, you know, what works for you. Do you care about story? Do you care about gameplay? Do you care about narrative? Do you care about how a game feels in your hands? Do you care about competitive play? Do you care about social play? Do you care about sort of the, you know, more sociological aspects of gaming? Do you care more about the art aspects of gaming? Find the thing that really sings to you. Games are multitudes, and they are doing a lot of things right now, from AAA big budget things to tiny little intimate indie things, from things that make you meet other people and interact with other people to incredibly solipsistic puzzles that you solve in a little cube all by yourself. Whatever it is that sings to you about games, write about that. Write about the thing that makes you feel like you want to write about games. You know, and don't just write about the games you like, which is important, but also write about why you like them. And that's really, or why you didn't like them. Write about why this thing you love is being failed by game X or game Y. Those are, I think, really important things that are better than just, I like this video game, 8.5. Don't do that.
And it's, this is, what we're talking about here is something you don't get from review sites, because that's not how they're geared to approach a review. Because when we write reviews like this about why we play and enjoy games, it's usually kind of centered around us. Your personality, the person reading your stuff has some kind of concept of where you're coming from. Where on a review site, nobody cares who you are. All they care is the score at the end and do I need to buy this game or not.
And we're pundits, basically.
Yes, that's what I always call myself, even though I, you know, carry game journalist tags. I don't like the name journal. I don't like the label journalist, because I do not report news. I comment on stuff. I snark at things.
I think critic is probably a better label than pundit, although I guess when we're talking about Nissan Leaf crap, it's punditry.
Exactly. But, and I mean, arguably, I do more of that than critiquing stuff, is I do more punditry. It's like, here's why your business sucks and it fails.
But whether you're doing criticism or punditry, both of them necessitate coming from you. Don't write what you want. Don't write what you think people want to hear. Write what you think people need to hear. Write what your real opinion is. Because that's the only way you're actually going to, you know, make a difference. Telling people what they already know or already want to hear isn't going to change anything.
I think the problem with the critic label is that it has been hijacked by these consumer advice reviews.
Yeah.
I actually want to...
Also... Oh, go ahead, Brett.
Actually, just real quick, want to add this to Chris's point. Even if you're... It's absolutely true that even if your idea isn't popular, you should share it. But don't try to exclude, don't ever try to exclude people who don't have, share your idea, unless it's something like, I don't know, related to slavery or women's suffrage or something. Like, don't ever, like, be like, okay, I think that the Grand Theft Autos are overrated, and if you don't think so, get the fuck out of my face. Because then they're not going to read the insightful article you post the week afterwards, or the week after that. Allow people to think that they can disagree with what you say and still, like, view you as somebody who's worth listening to. Chris pulls that off very well in his own stuff. I mean, he posted an extremely, many, several actually extremely unpopular videos, but a lot of those people still tune in to look at his stuff. Yeah, like, seriously, most of your videos, man, people just fucking hate them.
You're like the thing that made me love
Reddit threads for them.
The thing that made me love Chris was that he posted something negative about a game I loved, and he did it that made me interested in his opinion, and not like, oh, this guy's just a hater, but wow, this guy has a point, or I've never looked at this game through this lens. This is a new thing for me, and I'm very interested, and I want to hear more of what he has to say.
So yeah, that's the serious version of what I was saying, is what Shane was just saying.
And since we're talking about Chris, well, as if he wasn't here, even though he is, everybody should urge Chris to write somewhere civilized. Chris posts these long, thoughtful, brilliant, multi-paragraph thoughts into the sewer of Reddit. And then, you know, gets a bunch of, like, lol, hater, stupid.
You know he has a blog,
responses.
Right? You know Chris
he
has a blog.
He won't write on it. He won't write on the blog. He won't write on my blog. I've told him, you're welcome. Anytime you want to just throw some words on my blog, you can do it. You can write on your blog. Put it anywhere, but throwing into the sea of madness that is Reddit. He posts stuff to Facebook, and I'm the, like, me and his friends are the only ones that see it, and it's great stuff. And Chris, you're denying the world great stuff. You should be putting this down somewhere.
It's like if Hemingway was typing up these drafts, and then he was just, like, driving out to the middle of the woods and, like, tossing it to the hyenas or something. And then he's coming back, and his friends are just like, maybe you just want to, like, have a let us take a look at that? You know, we can get him published for it. He's like, no. I think this is where it matters.
You are writing on the bathroom wall of the internet, Chris. Stop doing that.
I'm sorry.
So, we've got
time for any more?
If you want to do one more, I want to wrap up quick here.
Yeah.
Yeah, we need to wrap up this Chris shaming and question answering session.
Yeah, do you have one or should I go with this one?
You go.
Okay, Ira says, Dear Diecast, a recurring topic for the Spoiler Warning crew is old games versus new ones, comparing and contrasting the styles and tropes used in the last decade and those now. So what do you think about forgiveness in video games? More to the point, do you think it makes it better to make something that the player does than something the character does with no input? For example, in Jedi Knight 2, Jedi Outcast, Kyle can go on a character arc from a gruff and pragmatic soldier to a compassionate Jedi, which concludes with him offering the Dark Jedi Desan a last chance at putting aside his pointless, childish plots. It's instantly rejected by Desan, who is characterized as being obsessed with not being weak, but it's there. On the other hand, in Dishonored, being merciful isn't really part of the story. The player decides on their own who lives and who dies, with the impetus to kill named characters like the Pendleton brothers being either their scumminess, boredom, wanting to try out new takedown strategies, wanting to see high chaos results. Part of this is, of course, that Corvo is so insanely shallow, and as has been harped on a lot, while Kylan Katarn at least has some character to him. But a sticking point is that the player can want to just tell off the end boss, and Kyle will treat him with stern kindness no matter what, while in Dishonored, Corvo can treat almost everyone, with the exception of Emily, of course, however the player wants. Is this expression better or worse, or just a different way of doing
it? The thing that I submitted, right?
Yes.
So this is really a question. He was actually just writing an essay on this topic himself. I mean, if you want
yeah,
to post
dude.
That up there, that's fine. But
yeah,
can I also just say that you know they established canonically that Kyle Katarn is a member of the Jedi Academy in Jedi Academy, and that apparently he carries forth like his you know pacifism, like you know you not pacifism, but like you know try to find another solution, try to find another way theory. You ever think there's a moment, like, where somebody's talking to Kyle Katarn, like, a student, and he wants to know how to control his anger or, like, how to solve a situation non-lethally, and then suddenly they're like, wait a minute. So, like, Kyle, how many thousands of people have you personally killed? Ballpark.
Well, there's this wonderful article by Todd Kelly, and it's an article I don't 100% agree with that I generally do, and I think I've mentioned this on the podcast before, but it's basically Ty Kelly talking about the non-existence of NPCs. Did I talk about that?
No. I have no awareness.
Basically what he does is he talks about how, you know, true role-playing is something that really only an incredibly small subset of players are really interested in. I mean, true role-playing, really getting into a role of something that they may disagree with, but really saying, okay, I'm Kyle Katarn, and I'm mad at this guy, and I'm willing to apologize for this guy. And in those situations, I mean, Ty Kelly's piece basically dismisses the entire idea of role-playing and NPCs in general, or not NPCs, sorry, player characters. It's about the death of player characters, not NPCs. But
Oh, okay, yeah, I remember this piece.
Yeah.
I'm actually I'm actually personally having trouble with this. I am currently doing some game writing, and it's difficult to write a character. Like, even if you're writing multiple player characters, it's difficult because you feel like you have to accommodate every way that the player wants to handle the situation. You can't just say, well, X character, I don't need to include X option because this character wouldn't have that option. I have to be like, well, it's not my character anymore. It's the player's character. I have to accommodate them.
Well, it's interesting because what Kelly basically says is that player characters don't exist for the vast majority of players out there. 80 to 90% of the people that are playing your game are playing your game's system, not your game's story. They're not there to, empathize with Kyle Katarn as this character who might be empathetic and apologetic to a person who's wronged him. They're there because they're going to beat the game and they're going to min-max all of their powers to be the most awesome thing they can, and it really ruins your ability to sort of have that concept of players working with you to tell a story. They don't work with you. They min-max your systems and then they try to win. That's what games are to the vast majority of people who play them. And as a result, player characters are extraordinarily difficult to do because only a small subset really actually engage with player characters. And I think that there's room for both, but I think something like the Kyle Katarn situation does necessitate someone who's willing to take on the role of Kyle Katarn and not really simply be like, I hate that guy. He was a bad guy the whole game, and he sent his troops after me, and I hate him. Why is Kyle apologizing? I hate this game. If you're not going to role play, then yeah, I think sort of a forgiveness mechanic doesn't work for you, and I think it needs to be core to its own systems the way, say, Dishonored does. But if you're going to actually role play, then I think it works better.
I mean, we actually complain about this on spoiler warning occasionally. Like, especially the thing that comes to mind is the end of Assassin's Creed 2, where Ezio lets the Pope go, even though he'd like been responsible for murdering a bunch of people, and Ezio had killed tons of people to get there. And we do kind of get mad when characters do stupid in air quotes stuff or stuff that we wouldn't do in that situation. I don't know. I think it really has to do with how strong and internally consistent the character is. Like, if you've got a really powerful protagonist, I'm trying to think of an example, but it's not coming to mind right now. But someone that has a very strong arc during a game, and then you have them doing stuff that the player might not want to do in that situation. I think the player would understand it more if that game goes out of its way to engage the player in that story. And I think the idea that all player characters are basically pointless exercises because most players won't emphasize with them or want to play them the way that the character would indicate that it should be played, is kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy because, especially for up until the 2000s and even now, game stories have been primarily just backdrops for basically gameplay mechanics, or in the case of things like RPGs, the character itself is basically a stack of Play-Doh that you can mold to be whoever you want. And having a strong player character that does certain things that the player doesn't want them to do is not a very common thing. And I think that, there's room for a story that would do that, but the stories that have been done so far haven't really been doing that kind of thing. That said, I really do like Kyle Katarn, and the Jedi Knight series is one of my favorite 90s shooters. And well, Jedi Outcast I didn't like quite as much, but the first two Jedi Knight games were pretty fun, and I thought Kyle Katarn was a pretty good protagonist. But then I also find myself role-playing characters in a way that apparently, according to that article, most people don't.
Well, I think maybe you could make the argument that whether you agree to play the character or not, if the character suddenly forgives someone It's usually if the character suddenly is being, gracious and forgiving in a way that feels hollow and dishonest and unearned, I do think that that will hurt whether you're role playing or not,
Right. Yeah. Yeah, okay. See, that's something I need to make the distinction of for, because when I say powerful player protagonist and a powerful narrative, I mean one that is also internally consistent. Like Kyle going from this kind of gruff, angry guy to someone who'd be willing to forgive his opponent is a strong element of his character arc in Jedi Outcast, and is actually part of the title because I believe he starts the game off having basically renounced all of his force powers and his obligation to the Jedi because he didn't like the kind of person that he would become when he was using those powers. And the whole game is about him slowly coming to accept that and learning to kind of control his temper. But in comparison to with say Assassin's Creed 2, it's sort of end thing where like, oh, I've killed all these people and gotten all the way here, and I can stop you from killing more people, but I'm kind of tired, so I'm not going to do it. That was somewhat less powerful. And
You
was not
seem like
helped
a
by the
nice
fact
enough sort.
that Ezio was kind of a broken character at that point.
He's the Pope. You don't kill the Pope. You put him in fancy shoes and you put him in a bulletproof bubble and you send him on his way.
Unless you're playing Crusader Kings.
I gotta be honest, I completely spaced out from this conversation until that line.
It is a good line to come back to.
What I'm saying is, I think that such a player character can work in the event that the narrative is strong enough to support it.
Also, you shouldn't kill the Pope. I think that's another takeaway from this speech.
Oh, do we have time for one more question? And then, 20 minutes later, we
I'm
have the
sorry.
longest
It was
podcast so far on
only
our hands.
10 minutes, and the longest podcast was actually the second one, I think, or the third. The one
All
where
right.
you weren't there and we just went
Yeah,
on a crazy tangent for like 30 minutes longer than we should have.
we don't even know how long this is yet. Josh has to edit it down. He could cut me out completely, and it could be like a half hour.